Good afternoon. Welcome to our second session here, which is titled Life After the Dead, Jam Bands, Deadheads, and Mourning. I'm not sure where the mourning comes in, but probably because we don't have the dead to follow around anymore. But we're going to talk about the void that was left by the band and get a couple of young perspectives here about the jam band scene, and then I'm going to do some reminiscences, and maybe that's the mourning part of it. Looking back to 96, not long after we didn't have tours to follow around anymore. So Chris is going to start things off here. We have a wide geographic range here. I'm from Florida. Chris is from Oregon. And then we've got the good old Mid-America here with Lawrence, Kansas, with Liz Yeager. And so that's what we're going to talk about. So, Chris, if you would, jam band scenes, and take it away.
Excellent. All right. This is called Jam Band Fans and Subcultural Borrowing. This is actually the second, a very condensed section of my second chapter of my dissertation. So, post-subculture studies scholars argue that there is no foundational subculture anymore. Each includes copies, or as Paul Hodgkinson says in his study on goth, each subculture borrows from several other styles, from subcultures that came before. Group identities are no longer formed along clear lines between race, class, and gender. Boundaries between subculture and the mainstream, or popular, are becoming ever more blurred, such as it is with today's jam band subculture. Members of the jam band subculture are not all working class, as with the punks, or all middle class, as with the hippies, but come from various walks of life. Like Bakhtin's Carnival, there is, quote, free and familiar contact between people of many different classes, ages, and genders. The jam band subculture today is actually a hybrid of different subcultures, much like what the post-subculturists talk about today. Not only rooted in the hippie subculture of the Ashbury and the Deadheads, today's jam band subculture is made of borrowings from several other subcultures, most prominently the Bohemians, the Beats, Rastafarians, and Ravers. The fact that the jam band subculture borrows their styles from subcultures that came before them, the resistance found in those original styles and philosophies has been weakened. Post-subcultural scholars have begun to look at subcultures as something that is performative, that is something that is on the surface of the member of the subculture and has no real authenticity. This discipline challenges the work of Dick Hebdige and others as part of the Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies at the University of Birmingham, or simply the Birmingham School, which examined the, quote, spectacular subcultures, unquote, of 70s Great Britain, which resisted against the mainstream culture. The youth of these subcultures were oppressed, disenfranchised, and expressed this with their angst with mainstream culture through their style. In the introduction of the post-subcultures reader, David Muggleton and Rupert Weinzierl say, regarding the Birmingham School, quote, the era seems long gone of working-class youth subcultures heroically resisting subordination through semiotic guerrilla warfare, unquote. The post-subcultural group of theory believes that the potential for style to resist society is lost. There is no longer a differentiated line between a, quote, parent culture, which is Dick Hebdige's term, and subculture, which resists their parent culture. Contemporary subculture seems to be more fluid and complex, moving between these two worlds. Subcultures are part of the society they resist, as well as copying the mainstream that they resist. A cultural studies scholar, Sarah Thornton, calls They copy the mainstream in their use of what subcultural studies scholar Sarah Thornton calls subcultural capital, borrowing from Bordeaux, in order to create hierarchy. The post-subculturists have looked for ways to describe this change in subcultures and have even challenged the term subculture, exchanging it for terms like neo-tribes or sub-channels, among other things, which emphasize this fluidity of subculture today. But for the purpose of this paper, I'm just going to keep it subculture. Subcultures today are a veritable pastiche of styles that they get from what Muggleton calls the, quote, supermarket of style, a term I'm not too excited with, but it works. As subcultural styles have been borrowed from those that came before, any political resistance is erased. And the club culture's reader, David Muggleton, says of this post-subcultural style, quote, there are no rules, there is no authenticity, no reason for ideological commitment, merely a stylistic game to be played, unquote. Today's youth cultures merely perform identities that are constructed from past subcultures and resistances removed, as I said before. Subcultures of today have become Baudrillard's simulacra, merely copies with no original, according to Redhead. These scholars would refer to Jamban subculture today as a post-subculture or neo-tribe or sub-channel or whatever they are choosing at the moment. One can find the roots of this subculture as far back as the 13th and 14th centuries. Henry Miller in On the Fringe, The Dispossessed in America, discusses the roots of the hippie subculture, which is the roots of the Jamban subculture, and that these roots can be found in the Middle Ages. Groups like the Gnostics, a sect of Christianity, rejected the church in their worldly life to form utopian communes. The diggers of 1650, named for the digging needed to cultivate food, lived in a commune in which private property, class, and authority was non-existent. Of course, the countercultural diggers brought free food to people there in Haiti during the 1960s. I think that's where they got their name. Miller also discusses Les Bozingos, the predecessors to the 19th century Bohemians who rejected traditional clothing and the church and wore their hair to emulate the flame of knowledge. Yeah, I think I was trying to picture that in my head too, and I was thinking like maybe, you know, I don't know how that would look, but yeah, I think like a mohawk. Although Bohemianism's peak was in the 19th century France, it has always been a state of mind for youth, according to Bohemian scholar Cesar Grania. He argues hippies and beats were Bohemian groups, however all Bohemian groups have their own characteristics. Bohemianism has existed for centuries, but according to Grania, it has always had one characteristic shared by every group and every movement. Quote, an attitude of descent from prevailing values of middle-class society expressed through lifestyle and art, unquote. Their lifestyle was communal, and their art was and their art expressed their politics. However, in order for this to happen, they needed the shocked mainstream for their protest to be effective. Beats were a bohemian group in the U.S. in the 50s who indirectly inspired the hippies and the Jamban subculture. They too were borrowing subcultural style as they looked to black musicians at the time called hipsters as inspiration. And a side note, this black jive term comes from the term hipcat, which came from the West African Wolof language, hippicat, a term for a sage or wise man, and this essentially evolved into hipster. And I suppose right now my friends who live in urban areas are talking about a new kind of hipster, youth that are sort of empathetic and don't care about anything. So that's interesting that it's also, this term hipster is continuing to evolve. Whole new paper there. All right. These hipsters parodied white coolness as a way for them to escape the stereotype of the happy, subservient black American. The Beats, all white, copied the hipsters' coolness and essentially became a parody of a parody. Again, that's a whole other paper. Like the Bohemians, the Beats chose voluntary poverty to make a statement. The wealth that the United States had suddenly experienced in the post-World War II era suffocated the Beats. They were against societal pressures to have families, jobs, and perform upstanding behavior. Rejecting these middle-class normative values, the Beats chose their own, living life on the road, hitchhiking, drinking alcohol, and meditating on narcotics, which was another important part of the Beat subculture. As disgruntled young men, drugs, most popular being marijuana, peyote, mescaline, and sometimes heroin, proved to be an excellent escape from 50s America. Both the Beats and Bohemian lifestyles and philosophies included voluntary poverty, communal living, and traveling in order to protest standards of society. Beats and Bohemians often lived in boarding houses, later to become the crash pads of the San Francisco hippie movement, and met in cafes and community centers. Traveling inhabited the Beats' lives as encouraged by Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Since many were homeless and chose poverty, traveling was a romantic option as a lifestyle. One can see these elements, the elements of the Beats and Bohemians in Jamban subculture. An important aspect of the Jamban subculture is travel and transience, as it was with the Beats and Bohemians. Some fans travel to just one show or a small handful of shows, while more enthusiastic fans will travel to all the shows on one tour. In the case of the Grateful Dead, fans could be traveling for months. Some fans, in the case of the String Cheese Incident, who had their own travel agency offering travel packages to shows outside the U.S., traveled all over the world. Being on the road and traveling is a large part of the subculture. Large numbers of fans choose camping as accommodation. Tent cities are formed at festivals and in fields owned by farmers near amphitheaters. And this emulates the sort of voluntary poverty and communal living of the boarding houses of the Beats and the Bohemians. In San Francisco, as the Beat movement was going strong, the hippie movement was forming. Much like the Bohemians, the hippies were mostly middle-class youth who, in protest of American middle-class values, dropped out of society and formed their own urban communal living situation within the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. Hippies used recreational drugs to free their mind of middle-class thinking, and many aspects of this experiment were communal. The diggers offered free food, as stated above. There were free places to stay, the crash pads, an extension of the boarding houses, free medical clinics, free concerts. There was also free stores where people could come and take whatever they needed. While the living was communal, the hippie movement was removed from the art and literature that were the large part of the Beats and Bohemians' lifestyles. However, their choices were extremely political. Hippies were creating a new community with a common purpose and identity. After the Haight-Ashbury stopped being the community the hippies wanted, they tried something different and moved their communal living situations into rural areas to try their experiment again. As the Grateful Dead were a part of the hippie movement of the Haight-Ashbury, many deadheads were hippies. The deadhead subculture appropriated a good deal of the hippie ethos, which the jam band fans have carried on somewhat into the 90s and 21st century. As the Haight-Ashbury scene disintegrated, the deadheads began to follow the band as a way of, quote, sustaining a countercultural way of life developed in the 1960s and 70s, unquote. Jam band fans today have continued that tradition and, in a way, live communally on tour and at festivals. Even if not intentionally, fans find themselves staying in the same accommodations. Some fans share rides and accommodations with other fans in need. Campgrounds and festivals become tent cities. There's a sense of community created by this nomadic travel, much like the community that was created by the hippies, Beats, and Bohemians. Not having a stable lifestyle or place to stay, even just for a few weeks or months, is a large part of jam band fandom. Fans while on tour have appropriate hippie, Beat, and Bohemian values, such as communal living, sharing, and living in poverty. Although many fans are not really living in poverty, it appears as if they are, living in tents, dressed in handmade clothing, selling food, but really there's a lot of money there, I think. Also, inequality from such things as class and gender. All this is really only apparent on the surface of the subculture. It's a performative. They're performing in opposition when actually it's gone. These fans live a collective lifestyle like the hippies, yet when there is no tour, they are dispersed like the Beats. The internet has become their metaphorical cafe or City Lights bookstore, which creates a community online. Drugs are also a large part of the subculture, as with those that came before it. For example, if you look like a quote-unquote authentic fan, you may be offered drugs in the lottery and the concert. While hippies use drugs as means of self-reflection, expanding their minds past normative values, jam band fans use them for various other reasons. Could be spiritual, could be just for leisure. Drugs and alcohol have become such a force in the jam band subculture, so much that some fans have created their own sober organizations, such as the Wharf Rats, Fellowship, the Gateway. These groups provide support for fans who are recovering or need a sober community at shows. Another subculture that places drugs at a place of importance within it is Rastafarianism. This subculture is a religion from which the jam band fans of today have appropriated style, music, and in some ways philosophy. Rastafarianism was a messianic movement in Jamaica, which saw Haile Selassie I of Ethiopia as their messiah. Rastafarianism began with Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement in the early 20th century. In 1916, he told blacks in North America to, quote, look to Africa where a black king shall be crowned, unquote. When Selassie was crowned in 1930, the Rastafarians believed that he was the messiah and Garvey was a prophet. Growing groups of blacks in Jamaica rejected their society and government and wanted to be transported back to Africa. Rastafarians began to see themselves as captives in Babylon, which is essentially white oppressive society, and they were waiting for deliverance from Jah, their god. Although Rastafarianism is a black religion, jam band fans, who are overwhelmingly white, appropriate the style and music of Rastas. Dreadlocks, a style of protest, are common among many white fans in the jam band scene. jam band fans are also seen wearing the colors of Rastafarianism. Anyone who goes to a jam band show will notice a large number of fans listening to Rastafarian music, wearing Rasta colors. Gypsy Rose catalog, a sort of hippie style, jam band style catalog, has a section titled Marley Rasta Swag, which contains white models wearing Rasta-colored clothing with dreadlocks. The catalog also sells dreadlock wax, dreadlock soap, and a, quote, supa-dupa dread kit. So, as we see, the sort of black back to Africa movement has been totally erased in this in the style, in this catalog. Reggae music is also very popular among jam band fans. Jam bands themselves cover many Bob Marley songs, as well as write their own reggae song. For example, a popular song in the Fish repertoire was a reggae tune called Maki Supa Policeman, which I think is just about smoking marijuana and getting caught. Although I'm not quite sure. By the lyrics, they're kind of strange. But supposedly, Maki Supa is a Jamaican word meaning acting stupid for no reason, according to fish.net. But still, the song is very far removed from the original genre, the religion that was there. While many jam band fans appear to be resisting societal values as well as appropriating styles of Rastafarianism, the religion itself, as I said before, has seemed to have been erased. Some jam band fans grossly appropriate the Rasta's religion style for their own expression. Although the fans believe their style is one that is resistant, and in its original context, it is. But the fact that they are borrowing from another culture and erasing its context is grossly imperialistic and mirrors the culture which they sought to resist. In this way, of course, the boundaries between the mainstream and subculture have been borrowed, as they're now starting to act like that oppressive white mainstream that they're resisting. Another subculture which influences the jam band scene today is raver culture. As with the other subcultures described in this chapter, dancing, music, and drugs, of course, are cornerstones of this subculture. The music that is associated with raves is electronic techno music, but there are many, many different types of that. And the drug ecstasy goes hand in hand with the music, supposedly adding to the oceanic, utopian experience to which the music is said to lead. The raver culture was one that believed in peace, love, and utopianism. Not unlike the hippie values of the 60s. But these feelings are mostly associated with the drug ecstasy as well. The drug is taken orally as a pill and causes feelings of euphoria and benevolence. Whereas it was commonly believed that this drug enhances sexual experiences, cultural studies scholar Simon Reynolds claims that this is not true and that the rave subculture was the first to, quote, reject the subversive status of sex. Rave instead inhabits a childlike, innocent love, a, quote, pre-Oedipal infancy, end quote. Ravers suck on lollipops, candies, and pacifiers, play with toys and props, and wear clothing that is very childlike, which often features characters from children's cartoons. And their music many times samples nursery rhymes and children's television theme songs. Ecstasy, a new drug in the late 90s, is sold and used at jam band shows today. And through this, you can see how raver culture has infiltrated the jam band scene. The childlike style of raver culture is appropriated in handmade clothes which feature children's characters, and many of which are made from old childhood bedding. I once had a dress I made from Popple's sheets. I had, if anyone remembers Popple's stuffed animals, I don't know. I used to see people wearing, you know, clothes they made out of their old children's sheets, and I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. I'll go sew myself a Popple's dress. And I really liked it. And, you know, and then I kind of realized, like, where this all was coming from. Interesting. They seem to be a combination of handmade clothes, common in the jam band subculture, with the childhood theme of raver culture. Lollipops, glitter, bubbles, and glow sticks are all other rave toys commonly seen at jam band shows and festivals. The popular glow stick or glow ring wars are an event at most festivals that began during long jams at Fish shows. In 1994, according to Fish.net, it started during a Harry Hood song. Fans began to throw glow sticks and glow rings across the venue, appearing to move with the jam. Now, side note, a lot of smaller jam bands today have said, don't bring glow sticks because they don't want to get hit by them. So,
annoying.
So I feel that that sort of thing, the glow stick war, is really an influence of raver culture and ecstasy. Otherwise, it would not have become such a phenomenon in the subculture. The subculture reaffirms what the post-subculturists say, that there is no foundational subculture anymore. All subcultures borrow from those it follows, erasing original intent of styles. There appears to be a huge shift in jam band fandom from the predecessors of the subculture, the Deadheads, to jam band fans today. Deadheads were a part of a counterculture that was a huge part of the social history of the United States. As the hippie subculture dispersed in San Francisco, Deadheads continued the lifestyle and tour with the band. This kernel, in a small way, is still with jam band fans today, however. The subculture has evolved into something that is very different from the hippies and the Deadheads. Jam band fans today are part of a subculture in which the ethos and style of many different subcultures are contained. Jam band fans today perhaps believe they are being subversive and political, but are actually a necessary cog in society. Jam band fans make money, they spend money, yet they perform a seemingly anti-capitalist, anti-mainstream identity. Much like imperialist cultures, jam band fans steal and manipulate styles from the Rastafarianism, a third world religion, erasing the original intent of those styles. Does this make the performance of subversive ideals by the Deadheads more authentic? Of course, that's a problematic word, authentic, than the performance of ideals of jam band fans today. Can a performance of subversive ideals even happen within the subculture with which it borrows and steals from others? Does subcultural borrowing style really erase oppositional intent? And those are just some questions that I'm dealing with in writing my dissertation. So just wanted to end with those. Thank you.
Chris Alabama, thank you.